Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Have a big announcement. I have a new website. KevinRose.com is the place to go. There is a tab at the top there called podcast. If you click on that, you'll get access to all of my previous shows, which I guess you already get through your podcast player, but I have all the show notes. So I'm starting to link up every single show with show notes, with actionable clicks. So if I talk about any products or any services or just anything that's clickable, I link it up right there. So head on over to KevinRose.com. And you can also sign up for my newsletter there. So I put out a once a month newsletter. There's also a tab for the newsletter. Click on that and you will have access to my newsletter that is filled with my favorite articles every month, videos, just things that I'm finding that are odd from around the web that I want to share with you. And last plug is my new app. I have a new app out there called Oak. It is a free meditation app, 100% free, no monthly subscription and no banner ads. So you can download Oak initially for iOS, but I hope to bring it to Android. Just go into the App Store and type in OAK. It'll come up there and give it a shot. Let me know what you think. I've spent probably the last 6 or so months working on this, trying to build a really awesome resource for people that are just getting into meditation and want to learn general mindfulness meditation. The other thing that we have inside of the app that I use absolutely every day, even if I don't have time to do a meditation, are the breathing exercises. At first glance, you think, what is a breathing exercise actually do? Well, these are very old, like thousands of years old pranayama yogic breathing exercises that really put me in just a good mental state and ready for bed. I try the deep calm just before I go to bed. It's the 4-7-8 breath. You'll see it there in the app. And give that a shot. And I'm telling you, after you use it for about a week, you will absolutely notice some changes. And I sleep better and I feel better when I do that breath. And I try to do that once, sometimes twice a day. So check out the meditation app, oakmeditation.com. Today's guest is Chris Hutchins. Chris is a former colleague of mine. We worked together at Milk, which was a little incubator that I had that we sold to Google. When we sold the company to Google, we both moved over to Google Plus. Chris was working on photos there, was the PM in charge of that. And then we both moved over to Google Ventures. And so we've worked together for quite some time. The thing that is really fascinating about Chris, and one of the reasons I wanted to bring him on the show, is that he is known in Silicon Valley as being the ultimate kind of life and finance hacker. So he figures out all of these little loopholes. And for me, he's helped me get, you know, free first-class international flights through just points alone. He also tells me about the latest and greatest credit cards, and we go into all the different credit cards and their different perks and why he uses one or the other. And he actually has like 12 different credit cards that he rotates through. He's kind of insane. He's a little over the top, but there is a lot of really cool things to pick up. A lot of cool tips to pick up in this episode. We talk about making passive income. We talk about this concept of FIRE, which means financially independent, retire early, how to monitor your credit score, and a whole lot more. Chris is kind of my go-to guy when it comes to figuring out how to hack the system and get some of these awesome little free perks that not too many people know about. So I guarantee you there'll be something in this episode for you that you'll pick up and take away and use in everyday life. One last thing, I want to let you know that we talk about a lot of different credit cards and a lot of these things, credit cards, financial services, you name it, they are linked to affiliate programs. Absolutely nothing is sponsored here. And when you go to my website and you click on the show notes, you'll notice that there are zero affiliate links. The only thing that I ever do in podcasts for affiliate links is something listed on Amazon. So I'll link up my affiliate code because it doesn't cost you anything. It's just found money and it helps pay for the various expenses that we have here on the show. So none of the credit card offers are linked up. I wanted to make that extremely clear just because it sounds like at times we get really excited about these various things on the show, and it sounds like we're kind of plugging them. We're not. Everyone lives a different lifestyle, and so some of these cards might work for you and some might not. So that's about it. Let's get into the interview. Chris, thanks for joining me on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. I mean, we have a long history. We should probably start off by talking about how we first met and ended up working together in multiple places. When did we first get together?
So I think you were trying to figure out what the team needed to look like at Milk, and you had asked around, and through Daniel or some people at Simple Geo, people pointed you in my direction.
Because you were doing BD at the time, And I just needed someone that was kind of a Swiss Army knife to come in and just run. I mean, you're basically like the COO, like just like coming in and setting up and running and optimizing everything.
Yep.
So we did that at Milk together. We sold that company to Google. We both joined Google Plus for a short amount of time. You went off to work on Google Photos.
Yep. Photos. Yep.
Yeah, we had a, if you can sense some hesitation in both of our voices, we had a bumpy time at Google Plus. We were, I would say that, how was your experience there?
So it was interesting. I joined, I was the PM for mobile photos. About 4 days later, Facebook buys Instagram, and mobile photos is really important. And I think the thing that I would say Google failed to take advantage of between you and I both was that we had a lot of ideas and they weren't ready to move as fast or as ambitiously as I think we wanted them to. And so my vision was, oh, wow, Google bought Instagram. I'm in charge of mobile photos. Android is our like hook to make photos successful. Let's go meet with Andy Rubin. He runs Android. It's going to work. And everyone's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. You just joined. Why don't you tackle some notifications? Why don't you just calm down? Like, no reason to try to change the world here.
Yeah, it was. I remember that I was talking to Kevin Systrom over to Instagram, and I knew something was going on in terms of like a potential acquisition, and so I took that to my boss at the time and said, "Hey, we should consider buying Instagram because I think this is a deal is going to go down here." And I remember we were talking about how much that price might end up being, and they just didn't want anything to do with it. They didn't think it was really a valuable asset. But you know what? Sometimes you get these right, you get them wrong. It doesn't really matter. We both ended up in a good place where we left and you got to send to Google Ventures, right?
Yeah. So we had raised that second extension round at Milk where
right, from
I
GV.
Got it from GV and Wesley Chan was involved. And I went to him and said, you know, everyone at Google, where is another home that might take more advantage of what Kevin and I are good at? And he was like, why don't you guys come here?
Yeah. And then that, thank you for that, by the way, because you saved our lives. Like we got out of Google Plus and we jumped over to GV and worked together there for a few years. And now you've got your own company, man. You broke off, you raised some capital and you're doing something that I'm really excited about because I feel like it is so well suited for your strengths in terms of getting into finance and helping people out. Do you want to like give people the 20-second version of what you're up to these days and yeah. your company?
So I left to take what I'm personally passionate about, finance, personal finance, frugality, optimization. And we started a company called Grove. And you know the way we're talking about it is we're like a personal trainer for your money. We help people figure out their situation and what they can do and how to get better and how to get real advice, not just from you know software that gives suggestions, but we have real certified financial planners on the team.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll get into that a little bit later. But one of the things that, and the reason I wanted to have you on this show is because for me and for a lot of other executives and folks that we probably can't name on the show, you have been, before you started this company, you have been known as this optimizer, this person that can, you're like the fixer. Like you like come in.
And legal fixer.
Yeah, not legal. You're not selling drugs or anything, but you come in and you help people either find the right credit cards or optimize their points or upgrade to first class or save for retirement. Or you've always been this person that is just really dialed in to this scene of like personal optimization. And I thought it would be really cool to have you on the show and talk to people about how they can do this and apply some of these little secrets that you have to their own life because it's amazing what you can do. I'll give you an example of one thing that you did for me probably, I don't know, maybe 2 years ago when I went to Japan. You know what I'm talking about? The trip.
Yeah.
You. So I had some points and I'm like, oh, I really want to go to Japan. Like, how can I get, you know, the best flight over there? And you ended up, I don't know how, well, we can talk about this, but you ended up getting me first class travel to Japan. But not only first class travel, you got me two combined seats that folded together into a lay flat, like queen size bed with like rose petals, like all over the, the ultimate first class. And I didn't pay, I mean, I might've paid some tax, like $50.
Yeah, I bet it was probably $50 to $100 a person.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And this was Singapore suites that I still haven't flown in them. They look amazing. They just upgraded them like a week ago. The new ones are even crazier.
It was just insane. And you did this all with points, but not just like, I didn't have any Singapore Airline points. So let's start off with credit cards and points. Like, what do points mean? Why do people accumulate them? Is it better to get cash back? Or let's give me your overview of that stuff.
Yeah, so it's funny. I saw someone reference points as the other portfolio. You know, everyone talks about their money, but what about their points?
Right.
And I definitely adhere to that. I track them everywhere. I have a spreadsheet that combines mine and my wife's. So the way I think about it is, you know, let's step back and say, number one, America, there's a lot of people, a lot of problems with debt. My suggestion is not go out and get a bunch of credit cards and put a bunch of money on them
right.
if you can't afford it. So we can get into that later.
But don't just get a card for the sake of, like, a good example. Actually, it's funny you mentioned this. My mom gets an American Express and it's $500 a year for the annual fee or whatever. And she's like, well, I want the points so I can get the upgraded travel. I'm like, Mom, you're spending like $3,000 a year on this card. Like, you're not getting enough points to even like cover the cost of the, you know, the annual fee. So anyway, that's kind of what you're saying, right?
So everyone needs to be financially responsible before you're spending lots of money on credit cards, and credit card debt is really expensive. And I think, you know, in America, there's, gosh, maybe almost $780 billion of credit card debt. So take that with caution and proceed. But, you know, when you spend money on a credit card, because, you know, America has this kind of situation, credit card companies are willing to pay you in the form of cash back and points to use their products. And if used responsibly, and if you pay off the bills every month, you know, with the exception of an annual fee, there isn't really any cost to you and you get massive rewards. I'd say that rewards fall into three camps: cash back, points for a specific program like United Airlines or Hilton, and then points that can be used across lots of different programs. Mm-hmm. Chase has Ultimate Rewards points. American Express has Membership Rewards points. Even Starwood points are flexible and can be transferred to dozens of airlines.
How many different cards allow the transfer of points?
I'll focus on the main ones: Ultimate Rewards, Membership Rewards, Citi has Thank You points. And Starwood, you know, while they are specific points to a hotel chain, they're very flexible and probably, you know, kind of well known as the most valuable point in the points world.
Which one is?
Starwood.
Starwood,
points.
Really?
Yes.
More so than American Express points.
Yes, I would say on a per point basis, Starwood points are definitely the most valuable. That said, you can get an American Express card that will give you, you know, 5x points on travel or 2x points on groceries. The Starwood card gives you one Starwood point for your purchases. And if it's not at a Starwood hotel, there's no bonuses. So they're, you know, because they're more valuable, they are more difficult to earn. And, you know, I've been accumulating Starwood points and, you know, I have less than half as many Starwood points as I do American Express or Chase Ultimate Rewards.
Okay, let's back up a second to what you said earlier about there being cash back or, you know, points tied to dining or whatever. How does anyone, the average person listening to this show, myself included, man, I'm just like so clueless when it comes to this. Like, do you really have to think when you pull out your wallet, okay, I'm at a restaurant, that means this card for dining because I get 4x points? Like, how do you determine when to take cash back versus when to keep the points? Like, did you get this in a spreadsheet or what's going on?
So there's the answer of what I do and the answer of what most people should start if they want to get into this. And they are very different answers.
Okay.
So I would say the first question is whether it makes sense to try to even get points or to just focus on cash back. Where points have their value is on international travel and business class travel.
Okay.
And expensive, luxurious hotels. So I would say, if you want to focus on being able to travel around the United States and you don't care about first class and you just want to travel anywhere in the country,
like free tickets,
domestically, free tickets,
okay,
you know, you're probably actually going to get as good a deal with cash back, if not better. It's when you want to cross an ocean. It's when you want to fly in first class. It's when you want to stay at, you know, the Park Hyatt in Tokyo, that all of a sudden playing the game and getting the points instead of the cash can take you a lot further.
Okay, so let's start there. Let's pretend before we go to, let's start with cash back. Okay, so is it simply just a matter of choosing the card with the most cash back and the lowest, you know, annual fee? Or how do you pick there if you're just like, okay, I just want pure cash back?
Yeah, I would say the kind of three things to think about. Assuming you're going cash back, I'm assuming you're not going, you know, traveling internationally a lot, but some cards have high international transaction fees. So that's a thing to think about. The annual fee, you know, is something to factor into the equation, but it's really what's the percentage cash back.
Okay.
I would say pretty standard is 2%.
Okay. And that's across the board. Do some cards offer more cash back on certain types of purchases?
Yeah, there's a bunch of cards that have recently launched. Uber just launched a card that I think is going to give 4% cash back on dining. The Capital One Venture card was long known as like one of the best cashback cards. The Barclays Arrival Plus card was really good, but they were all hovering around 2 or a little bit more across the board.
And in the cashback is not in terms of like, they don't give you cash back. What they do is they give you points that you can redeem to pay off your bill, right? That's cash back.
Yeah. So, you know, as long as however much cash back you expect to get, you expect to spend on your credit card, you'll end up effectively getting that back. But if you we're going to spend a lot of money and then you plan to never spend money ever again for the rest of your life, you might never be able to get that cash back. But for most people, as long as in the future they're going to spend 2% of what they spend now, they should be able to redeem that cash back.
Okay, so 2% is what we can expect.
2% is what I would expect.
What card what's the best card right now? And I know this changes month to month, right? Or is this something where it's like every 6 months you're changing cards?
The interesting thing is, if depending on where you spend your money, I actually think that, you know, there is a card, I'll just, you know, no need to delay, the Chase Sapphire Reserve card, where the effective cash back rate is actually going to probably for most people be higher than 2%. I would say a very subtly or slightly more complicated, you know, cashback redemption method. But I actually think that net, it is probably the best because it gives you the versatility of points or cashback across everything.
And so what's the annual fee on that?
Yeah. So that card has a seemingly high annual fee at $450. Your first $300 every calendar year are reimbursed if they are travel expenses. So if anyone spends more than $300 a year on travel, those first $300 are off. So you can effectively think of it as $150.
Gotcha. Okay. So when you said across the board, kind of net around 2% plus, how do you factor that in? Are you also using these points? Like if you have that card, are you using these points for other things like travel as well?
Yeah. So the reason I think that for most people, the Chase Sapphire Reserve is a great kind of versatile card is that it earns 3 points per dollar on travel and dining, which are very common credit card expenses for lots of people. Mm-hmm. And then 1 point on it per dollar on everything else. And those points can be redeemed in 2 ways. One, which is really great if you want to travel internationally and you want to upgrade or you want to, you know, cross an ocean or any of those things, is that you can transfer them to airlines. You can transfer them to Korean Air, which gives you access to all the SkyTeam airlines like Delta. You can transfer them to United and get all of Star Alliance. You can transfer to Southwest. You can transfer to Hyatt. So you get the ability to spread your points to wherever you want to fly to find an airline that flies there. Or you can just redeem those points for straight cash off travel. And you can do it at 1.5 cents per point, effectively making your travel and dining spend 4.5% cash back and your regular spend 1.5% cash back.
Crazy. So is there any benefit to having a secondary card on top of that that may optimize a little bit more? Like you said, for example, Uber does the new card is going to do 4X on dining.
Yeah.
So why not just get the Uber card and just use it for dining expenses?
Yeah. So if you're going to get 3 points for every dollar you spend on dining with the reserve, Chase Sapphire Reserve, and each of those points is worth 1.5 cents, then you're getting 4.5% cash back on restaurants. And the Uber card is going to get you 4.
I see.
So across most of those verticals, you're not really getting more. The thing I would tell most people to do is evaluate where the bulk of your spending is. If you're spending all of your money on office supply stores, there's a Chase card that'll give you 5X points at office supply stores.
Right.
Right. Like, so
is that true?
It is. Yeah.
What's it called?
It's called the one I have is the Chase Inc. Bold.
And you actually have this card?
Well, so the argument is, and this is going to go down towards where I get a little crazy, is, you know, we walk our team to lunch. We go to Whole Foods a lot and we buy groceries at Whole Foods or we buy from the hot bar. And you can go to Office Max and you can buy a Whole Foods gift card. So I'll go to Office Max,
oh my,
buy $1,000 of Whole Foods gift cards so that we can take the team out for lunch every day, and put it on a card that gets 5x points on office supply stores.
See, this is what I'm talking about, like the crazy shit that you do to like overly optimize. So you're buying Whole Foods gift cards at Office Max so you get maximum points to take your team out.
Yeah, and they have gift cards for restaurants. They have gift cards at Target and Starbucks and everything. So like, I could buy Amazon gift cards there and do all my Christmas shopping and get 5x points.
Now, wait a second. Yeah, Amazon's a great one because I have... The Amazon card.
The premier one that gets 5%
cash back on. 5% cash back on.
Yeah.
Is that a good card for me to use?
I think that if you're spending a lot of money on Amazon.
I am.
Then 5% cash back is, you know.
It's the best.
Probably the best.
Okay, good.
Short of a crazy go the next step, buy gift cards, redeem the gift cards. Like, yes, I think what you're doing is right.
Okay, good.
Most of the reason I don't go and do that for Amazon is that, you know, another added perk is a lot of credit cards, Chase is particularly good at this, especially the Visa Signature cards, have purchase protection, return protection, price protection. So if you buy something on Amazon and the price drops, you can just ping Chase and they'll cover the difference.
Wow.
If you buy
something... Are you serious?
Yeah. If you buy something and it breaks within 90 days, you can ping Chase and they'll pay for it.
So how... Okay. This is where you and I differ a little bit because like you go to the extreme to make an extra... little bit like percentage of like if you monitor this stuff and if a price drops, you get the difference. How long do I have to wait on hold if I'm going to call in? Like, let's say I buy some macadamia nut milk, which I just did the other day on Amazon, and the price goes down by 50 cents. And it's like, okay, I can get $7 back if I call and make this call. Am I going to be waiting a half hour for that $7?
Yeah. So there's a company I found on the internet called Earny, E-A-R-N-Y, and they just monitor your Amazon transactions. And if they're on Chase cards, they either, I don't know what they do because I haven't gotten to this point yet, but they either just file the claim for you or they alert you that you can. And Chase will let you do it online.
Oh, wow.
So my iPhone, about a year in, I broke the screen. We've all done it.
Right.
It hadn't been 90 days. So I go to the Apple store, I pay the $100 or whatever it costs, and I get a new screen. 3 weeks later, I broke the screen again. Call, went to the Apple store, paid for it, sent the receipt to Chase and said, hey, I bought a screen at Apple for $120.
Oh my God.
It broke. Can you guys pay for it? And then they sent me a check for $129 or however many dollars, and they paid for the screen.
So they weren't paying for the original screen. They're paying for the fact that you bought a replacement screen and had that broken.
Yeah.
And then they paid to replace that. Who has the best price protection? Like, who's not going to give you the most? Because one of the issues is like, you know, I've tried a couple times and it's a lot of... At least it was back in the day. It was a lot of like, I need to prove that this actually happened. Like, how hard is it to actually file these claims?
Yeah, so I've filed a few and I've told people at the office that break an iPhone within 90 days to file them. I would say it is a little work. You can do most of it online. You have to submit the receipt. Sometimes if it's a little confusing, in my case, trying to get them to replace a screen repair, you might have to talk to someone for 5 minutes. But you know, for the average person, if your screen breaks, you pay $129, you can get that back spending 15 or 20 minutes. I imagine that's a worthwhile 15 or 20 minutes.
Oh, for sure.
Most cards have purchase protection. It usually lasts somewhere between 90 days or more, mostly 90 days. A lot of cards have extended warranty protection. So I think Chase and Amex, if you buy something, if you bought a MacBook and it broke in year two, they extend your warranty by a year. So if Apple covers you the first year, they'll cover you the second
year. So who does that repair though? I can't take it to Apple and be like, hey, I have a Chase.
So extended. Most of the time you contact Chase and they'll pay for the repair and you get it done at Apple. So my screen replacement, I got it done at Apple and I sent them the receipt.
Wait, so you have to do the repair first and then take that receipt and then file that with Chase. It's not the other way around, right? You don't contact Chase first, say this broke, where do I take
it? You could contact Chase and say this is out of warranty. This is how much it's going to cost. And they might say, great, go fix it. I'm trying to think what I did. I did this with some electronic like 5-6 years ago. It was out of warranty and it was something that you actually pay a repair person for, like a TV, versus something that the cheaper alternative is to replace it. You might do something else, but I had a laptop and I think like the second year in, one of the keys was broken. I had to get a new keyboard. Chase paid for that keyboard or Amex paid for that. I don't remember which, but like this is part of the perks they offer. And I guess they're so underutilized that they keep offering these amazing perks.
So give me your top five perks. Like what cards offer them and what do you think are just like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm getting this for free or this is a great perk.
On the credit side, I think most credit card issuers do most of these things. I know Amex does not cover price drops.
Okay.
But Chase does. And you know, I looked it up a couple of days ago. I think it's Discover and MasterCard. Like most of the credit card issuers cover most of these things. So I would say if you just double check that your card covers it, you know, I make sure that I don't buy something that I might want that might break with an Amazon gift card, because then I don't have any protection.
I see.
So I put everything, I make sure that anything that might break goes on a Chase or an Amex, because I know they're going to cover it if it breaks.
Gotcha. What about covering like overages and like extra bag checking fees and things like that? Like, are there, if somebody is listening here and they're like, I do a lot of travel, like what card then?
If you do a lot of travel, I would encourage you to do it with the most convenient airline for you, so that you can earn some type of status with that airline, and it'll typically cover those fees. You know, if you have the base level of status on most airlines, bag checks are free. You know, they'll probably let you skip to the front of the line when you're boarding. So I would say that's a place to start. A lot of airlines have programs where if you had status in one, they'll match you to the other. So if you want to change, it's not too difficult.
Interesting. So you can bring your status and say, do you have to call them up? Like, which airlines offer that status matching?
I would say almost every airline seems to have some program, whether it's a direct match, whether it's a challenge, where sometimes they'll say, oh, if you needed to fly 50,000 miles to get this, we'll give you a quarter. And if you just get 12,000 in that quarter, you'll get the status.
So explain to me real quick, what is airline status for people that don't know or are familiar with it, but you know, they don't know why should they pursue something like this?
It's interesting. I'll tell you why they should, and then I'll tell you why I've recently kind of just stopped caring about airline status.
Okay.
Airlines reward their most loyal customers because they know eventually they'll be less price sensitive because they'd rather just fly with that airline. And so almost every airline, you know, I'm trying to think of one that doesn't, rewards you in the form of either increased earnings of miles, premium seats, premium boarding, all kinds of stuff, upgrades, to, you know, for the more you fly with them. It's usually tracked by either how many miles you fly, how many dollars you spend, or how many points you earn. And they all have various benefits. One of the ones that I consistently try to achieve, which if you live in California right now, you're in luck, is Southwest has their highest tier of status is something called Companion Pass. Mm-hmm. When you achieve Companion Pass on Southwest, for the year you achieve it and the following year, you can nominate a person who will fly free, except for taxes, with you anywhere you fly on Southwest, always.
And so you have this status now. You use it with your wife, right?
I use it with my wife all the time. Right now, Southwest has a credit card that if you sign up for this credit card and make one purchase, they will give you Companion Pass for free next year.
Wow. Does that last for 2 years or just...
So it lasts for the rest of this year and next year.
Wow. So if you're flying a lot, that's a significant savings.
If you're flying a lot and you're flying a lot with the same person, it's significant. You know, I've used it to go to Mexico, I've used it to go to New York, to DC, to Los Angeles.
Oh, you can use it for international as well.
Yeah. So
I mean, I know they only fly to Mexico, right? Is that
they fly to Mexico, they fly to Jamaica, they fly to Belize, they fly to Puerto Rico.
So this could be like a, you know, $700-$800 ticket that you're buying, and then you get a matching one for free.
Yeah. My wife and I are going to Mexico City for Christmas, which, you know, traveling at Christmas isn't cheap, on Southwest. And I bought the ticket, added her. I think the international fees are a little higher. So it was like $30 instead of normally a domestic flight, I pay $5.60 in fees, and she flies for free.
Wow. So why have an American Express card? We haven't even mentioned them hardly at all. Is there any reason?
It's interesting. The only American Express card I have that I spend money on regularly is the Starwood American Express.
Okay.
So it doesn't fall into their membership rewards program.
And you're doing
program.
This for hotels. You want upgrades at hotels. Is that why?
So Starwood points, I think, are the most valuable. They can transfer to almost any airline. The way they transfer, if you transfer 20,000 points, they give you free 5,000 bonus points. So I keep Starwood points more because they're a versatile point that I can use.
How do you get them? I mean, I know you have to spend
money on your Starwood American Express card.
No, I get that. But like, when do you, like, you're so optimized on all these other things. Like, I'm at dining, I'm going to do my Chase. Like, what purchase in your life, like, warrants you pulling out the Starwood card?
Yeah. So if I narrow down how I spend money on credit cards to like the super basic version, it's I put travel and dining on Chase Sapphire Reserve, and I put everything else on something else. And what I would encourage people that don't want to get too far into this is the best something else card, if you don't want to have lots of different cards and you want to keep all your points in one place, would be the Chase Freedom Unlimited. It's just 1.5% on everything. So you get 3x on travel and dining, 1.5 on everything else. Two cards, they earn the same type of points. Those points can redeem for cash. They can redeem for miles on a bunch of airlines. They can redeem for hotel points. Super simple, same points balance. You don't have to manage lots of things.
Well, you're saying just go with that one
Those two cards.
Those two
Sapphire cards. Reserve, Freedom Unlimited. Great combination.
Okay.
My version is I like having different pools.
So how many cards do you have?
I think right now, I looked this morning in anticipation of this, right now I have 13 different credit cards.
Are you kidding me? You got to break this down. When are you using these cards? Like for what? What's the most obscure one that you have? Like I get 7 times points on dog food.
It's got to be the Ink Bold. It's 5x on office supply stores and credit and phone bills and cable
bills. But why 17 cards? What are you doing with the other ones? I mean, you're not carrying a balance on any of these, I would assume, right?
No. It's not about that. It's about a few things. One, it's about, some of these cards I've had for a long time. I've got an Amex I've had since 2003. I've got a Chase card I got in college. And, part of your credit score is the average length of your history. So even though I don't use those cards regularly, they really bring my average to a larger number. So I don't want to get rid of them.
But let me ask you two questions about that. One, let's say I have an Amex card, which I have had also for a very long time. If I swap that out for the Starwoods version of that Amex, does that restart my kind of like length of credit with Amex?
Nope.
Okay.
No.
So can I cancel my Platinum and just keep will that reset it?
Or? Yeah. So what I did was I had a United card. I no longer needed it. I called Chase, said, hey, can I just downgrade this to a no annual fee card? So now I've got this card. It's no annual fee. I try to make sure I make one purchase a year so they don't close it out because it helps my credit. And I just leave it there. So Of my cards, there are a few that I've just had for a long time and I keep on there to keep my credit score high.
But if you have 18 or whatever cards, like, isn't that dinging your credit? Because I've heard too many lines of credit can actually hurt your credit score, correct?
So, I'm not a credit expert. I don't know how FICO, perfectly calculates the credit scores, but I do know the general makeup is there's a few components. One is, your average age of your history. So if you open a bunch of new cards, it's going to lower your average age because new cards, have no history. Your total number of accounts is something that more accounts actually helps. Your credit utilization, meaning of all the credit you have access to, how much are you using? If you're using too high a percentage of your overall credit, that can hurt. So if you open a new card and you have more credit and you don't spend more, you don't adjust to spend more, then your actual credit score could go down. Hmm. One is the number of inquiries or applications you have for new credit. Every time you apply for a credit card or a loan or a mortgage, you get a hard inquiry and it usually sticks on there for 2 years. If you do that, that affects your credit, negatively. After 2 years, it rolls off. The biggest one is your history, right? Mm-hmm. Have you paid your bills on time? Do you have any delinquent accounts? That's the biggest driver.
Have you ever missed a payment on accident?
I have probably missed one or two payments by accident.
How do you deal with that? Do you call them up and just apologize and hope they don't record it on your credit?
Or, yep.
What if they do a ding on your credit? Can you dispute that in any way?
I'd encourage everyone to download or visit Credit Karma. They know much more than I do about credit. They have a bunch of ways to dispute things that might be wrong.
Is that what you use?
I use Credit Karma to track my credit.
And you use their mobile app or?
I've used their mobile app, their website. I check it somewhat regularly in light of everything that's happened recently with the Equifax breach.
Yeah. Do you use LifeLock or any of that?
I don't use any of the monitoring services.
Do you lock down your credit scores though?
So I've done the 90-day fraud alert, which means that when you open up a new line of credit, people are alerted to take extra precaution and let you know. So I recently opened a credit card and they said, hey, we actually need to call and verify a few more personal questions in order to do this.
And you can turn that on for all three major bureaus then?
When you turn it on for one bureau, they're required to notify and turn it on for all three bureaus.
Oh, wow. I should do that.
It doesn't cost any money, which is nice. The downside is it only lasts 90 days.
Wait, then it goes away after 90 days?
And then after 90 days, you need to do it again.
Oh, wow.
Now, will that change in light of everything that's happened? I hope so. Will it just be the norm that when people want to open up credit, they take a little bit of extra time to verify your identity? I think that would be great.
I've locked down all mine, by the way.
Yeah. So that's
I've
the other
called
alternative.
Called in until
call,
hard luck.
Pay, freeze your account. The challenge there is if you ever wanted to open up a new account, you've got to call, pay, unfreeze, open the account, call, pay, refreeze, and it can get expensive.
Gotcha. But it's like $10 a time though, right?
Sure. But if you wanted to open up a credit card, you pay $10 times 3 accounts to open and close. Now you're spending $60.
I know that drives you crazy.
Yeah.
You love to optimize everything.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's move on from credit cards a little bit. This has been fascinating. So let's talk about just saving in general. and just because a lot of what you do day to day is like helping people save for retirement. I know that you've done so well that you could retire if you wanted to, and you've created passive income for yourself. Like, what do you think about, and how do you start to put together a plan to actually save so that, you know, you can retire at a decent age and you're not having to wait and until you're, you know, in your 60s or 70s to retire?
Yeah. So I think this was something that I now realize there's a massive movement around called, you know, some people say it's FIRE, financial independence, retire early. There's a ton of people that try to hack everything about finance and money so that they can have financial independence as early as possible. And some people are achieving it in their, you know, early 30s. You know, there's kind of a bunch of components to it, but, you know, it was something that was personally super exciting to me. And it's what kind of led us to start this company was that it's really hard to figure out what you need to do, what you need to, you know, have in order to live the life you want. And so, you know, we've kind of built a framework, I think, for what most people should be doing. And I think step one is to really just like take control of your situation. So unfortunately, some fun stats, I think, so 81% of Americans don't know how much they need to retire. 55% of Americans won't have enough saved to retire. And it's not just people at different levels of income or at lower levels of income. 25% of Americans making six figures are living paycheck to paycheck.
That's crazy.
It's crazy.
So where do you begin? If someone comes into you and they're like, hey, listen, I'm, you know, we're here in the Bay Area. I'm working at Uber or wherever, I'm making six figures, or maybe I'm making 85 grand a year. Like, how, I mean, we all know we need to save money, right? Like, that's just like, okay, that's a no-brainer. But what are the, what's the plan, and what's the thought process that has to actually, that sticks? Like, why aren't people doing this?
Man, so 85% of people feel anxiety. It's like, this is the number one cause of stress, number one cause of divorce. Like, money is, you know, difficult. So I think the first thing we always want to do is help people take control. So the way I would say take control is to really just take an inventory of where you're at, take an inventory, you know, alone or with your spouse, if you have one, on what's important to you, what are the priorities in life, and kind of short term, what does the next short term look like? So that would be step one.
Well, wait, what's an inventory of where you're at? What does that mean?
Sure. Like, so I would take all of your accounts, checking accounts, retirement accounts, credit card accounts, and either you could do this in a spreadsheet, you could do this with something like Mint, where you can put them all in one place and just kind of get an understanding of where you're at. Do you have more money than you have debt? You know,
you're talking about Mint.com.
Yeah. So Mint.com is a great, you can sync your accounts there. You can kind of put together, you know, what an accountant would call a balance sheet, what they would never call a balance sheet, and look at your net worth. Where are you starting? So the two things I think are important to understand are, where are you at from all of the accounts you have and your net worth? And then where are you at from a spending and saving standpoint? You know how much money you make, how much money are you spending? You know, that can be a harder thing to peg down because it changes month to month. But I think when you really understand those two things and you understand your priorities, you can really start to plan. And the priorities thing's hard, right? Like, what do you really care about? When people ask how to save money, I'm like, well, let's pause. What do you really care about?
Well, let's take one for the example of this podcast. Let's just say I care about retiring early. I want to do this FIRE thing you're talking about. How do you say that? FIRE?
I guess.
What is it?
Financial independence, retire
there
early.
There you go. I want FIRE. So if I want FIRE and I'm making a salary to where I feel like I could, I guess the thing that's frustrating for a lot of people is like, I certainly felt this in kind of my late 20s before I started doing startups, is that I was like, okay, I'm making decent money, but is it too late? And this seems like it's going to be 30 years of savings. And like, there's got to be some hacks and some shortcuts to get there sooner. So how are people retiring early?
Yeah. So, I mean, the number one way people are retiring early is spending less and really changing their framework for thinking about, you know, what's important. So there's a great book called Happy Money. It goes into like, what are the things you can spend money on to be happy? Lots of scientific research into it. You know, it's not buying a nice car. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, buying a nice pair of shoes or handbag or any of those things. Those things don't tend to drive people's happiness. And it's sometimes hard to just make a decision based on that knowledge. Where I think it becomes easier is where you understand how something you care about is affected by what you do. So example, you want FIRE. You want to retire early.
Right.
You want to save money. And you look at a purchase. The purchase isn't, should I spend this money? It's, how does that affect my ability to do the thing I care about? And if you care about retiring early, it might make it easier for you to say, maybe I should cook at home tonight instead of go out to dinner, because that will let me retire earlier. Mm-hmm. But if you don't take the inventory of your goals and what's important to you, and it might not be to retire early, it might be to buy a house, it might be to save for your wedding, it might be to, you know, save for children on the way, or saving for their college, or help your parents out. But once you identify what those are, and you kind of put together a framework for, are they in reason? Like, can I do them? And if you can't, then it's like, oh, now you've got this motivation of, there's a thing I care about more. And I would imagine that if people did that exercise, they would look at the, you know, shiny purse or the, you know, restaurant meal that's super expensive and say, you know what, I actually do care about being able to help my parents out, you know, with their retirement that they can't afford, more than dinner tonight. Right. But if you don't have that context, then you're just like, well, I make enough to go to dinner. I'm going to go to dinner.
Right. And then people just blow through their money and they're living paycheck to paycheck. So what do you recommend for someone coming in and saying, I want to hit this FIRE? Like, is there a certain percentage where you're saying, okay, 15% of your income per year should be going into savings? Like, how do you come up with that number?
It's interesting. I'd say it differs for lots of people. And the one thing I'll add to the concept of FIRE that's kind of funny is almost everyone that retires early ends up making money after retirement, right? Like, whether it's starting a blog or starting a company or just doing something they're passionate about, almost always leads to more creativity and ultimately more money. So it's an interesting thing that almost everyone I've seen that tries to achieve this, they're trying to find a way to get enough money that they can live for the rest of their lives without having to make any more money. And they end up making money in their retirement, if you will.
Right.
So it's an interesting goal. But for most people, if the goal is more to save for a house, the goal, you know, is more to save for retirement than just, you know, one particular thing early. You know, what we tell people is, let's focus on the next 5 years first. Let's look at what you need money for in the next 5 years. And if you look at how much you spend relative to how much you make, you can figure out how much you're going to have left over each year. And so if you're not going to be able to, you know, if you want to buy a house next year and you need $50,000 for a down payment and you have $10,000 and you only save $10,000 a year, you're not going to be able to do that. And that's when it starts to say, okay, what do we need to do to achieve that? And the answer there is, if in 1 year you need 50 and you have, you know, 10, then you need to save 40. Right. Otherwise, there aren't actually that many levers to pull.
Yeah. Well, what are the actual levers for most people? I know we're generalizing here, but like when you think about and you work with clients and you see a bunch of different scenarios where people are spending egregiously, where you're looking at this and you're like, oh my God, I cannot believe, like, Kevin, you're going out to fancy restaurants two nights a week or three nights a week. I would never do that. Like, what are the pain points that you see that drive you nuts where you think people could really implement a plan to cut back and start increasing their savings?
Yeah. So the main levers are pretty straightforward. It's adjust the magnitude of your goals, right? If you want to buy $1 million house and you can't, you could either, you know, reduce the size of the house you want. Mm-hmm. You could find a way to save more money, which means spend less or make more. So I kind of think, like, you can either optimize your lifestyle to spend less, you can make more, or you can change your goals. Like, those are really the only three levers.
Making more is probably the most difficult one of those three, right?
I would say making more is definitely, I think, the most difficult of all.
By default, you're already making as much as you possibly can. Otherwise, you'd be making more.
Yeah. Although there's an interesting study that looked at new grads and salary negotiations. And 80% of people who negotiated their salary ended up getting a higher salary. But, and I can't remember the number, it was a small number of people who actually did that. So there are some little things. Some people will say that one of the top, you know, 10 financial things you can do is just negotiate your salary. So that's one thing you could do. You know, you talked about passive income. There's side hustles where you can, you know, do all kinds of things. There's plenty of people in San Francisco driving for Lyft or Uber.
Well, let's get into your side hustles, man. I know you have a ton of little things that you've done. I mean, I guess you got your startup now, which is your full-time thing. But prior to your startup, you had a bunch of little ways to make money.
I just recently learned that one of the things I do is house hacking. When my wife and I purchased a home, we actually looked specifically for a home that had the ability to generate rental income within the home. Mm-hmm. The most common way people do this is they buy a duplex, they live in one side, they rent out the other. And if you are, you know, able to, sometimes you're able to make that income cover the entire payment.
And that's the case for you, or close?
And so for us, we have a 3-bedroom apartment, But the master bedroom has its own entrance, and we've put a lock on the door to the rest of the house, and we rent it out as a studio.
And do you Airbnb that, or are you...
We experimented with that, and it was just a lot for us. The time it takes to manage the inventory, to clean, you know, regularly, it just didn't fit with what we wanted. So we have a full-time tenant who's been there for, you know, 4 or 5 months, and, you know, he pays rent, and that rent we use to offset the cost of, you know, purchasing the house every month with our mortgage payment. In our guest room, we've Airbnb'd that from time to time. I think if you rent your room out for 14 or less, or less than 14 nights a year, the IRS doesn't consider it taxable income. So we've every now and then during a holiday or something rented out for a few nights.
You just stay right under that 14.
You know, we're at an age now where, you know, we have a dog, you know, we're, you know, in the middle of thinking about children, and like, I don't know, renting out your guest room is something that I feel like we've gotten past.
Yeah.
We'd love to have family and friends stay there.
Have you had any bad experiences with that? That's always scared me. It's like, I'm gonna be sitting there renting out a room, and I come home, somebody's freaking, you know, doing drugs on my table, or like, I don't want that.
Yeah, so I've been fortunate. We haven't had any bad experiences.
Okay.
But with a lot of the, you know, kind of house hacking style of generating income, you're having people rent out another separate unit. So right now we have a tenant in our studio, if you will, and like the door between our units is locked. Mm-hmm. So the worst case scenario, you know, he's destroying that unit. We have insurance, you know, hopefully that's not really a big deal. But, you know, I guess he could take a sledgehammer to the door. He could come into our house and take things or break things. I guess it's a risk. We met the person. We spent time with them. We did reference checks. It seems like a pretty low risk. And it's one that comes with every landlord in America.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, if you're having someone in your space, it's a totally different scenario. You have to be open to that. My wife and I traveled around the world couch surfing, so I feel like we're probably a little bit more open to that than many. So it's not for everyone.
So what other house hacks are there? Is that the main one then, is just renting out an extra room?
Yeah, I would say the main ones are renting out an extra room, buying a duplex and being able to rent out one of the units, renting out your place when you're out of town. I think those are the primary ones.
I know sometimes like during conferences, the rates can go up as well, right? So like choosing... Didn't you rent out your place one time when there was a major conference and you left town?
I think it was Salesforce or Oracle. That was one of the last times we've Airbnb'd our guest room. But I had just put our room on Airbnb, and I had put it at some like crazy price, thinking, well, I only need 14. I don't want to get over 14 nights a year, so I'll just put a really high price. And it was during some conference that someone wanted to pay like $400 a night to stay in our guest room. It was great because it was someone going to a conference. They were never there. You know, they were super tidy and respectful. And their company was paying for it. So, you know, the cost didn't matter.
Yeah. Conference goers, business conference goers, it's typically aren't the most rowdy kind of crazy bunch, although they could get a little hammered, but that's no big deal.
Yeah.
One thing I want to jump back to real quick on the retirement side is figuring out that number, you know, that kind of number that you need to retire. Like,
sure.
How do you think about that? Like, is it important to even do that? Or do you just start saving and say, well, I'll figure it out down the road? Or how do you think about that?
You know, step one, let's tackle today, right? So I'll get to your question. But step one is like, you need some sort of safety net. So before you're thinking about retirement, I would say, let's make sure that if something happens, you know, you're prepared. So I typically tell, you know, as a company, we typically tell people, depending on their income fluctuations, like anywhere from 3 to 6 months of an emergency fund would be great. Primary reason being that if you could, let's say you had, you know, a car repair that happened one day and it was $1,000. If you had prepared for that, the cost of that $1,000 is just going to be the $1,000 you saved. If you didn't and you had to put on a credit card, the cost might be the $1,000 plus whatever interest you have to pay on that credit card, which can be as high as 20, 25%. So step one is let's tackle the things that are really, really difficult. So,
but aren't those one and the same? Like, it's just cash in the bank you're saving. So retirement and saving for a car repair are the same thing.
I would say they're the same thing, but they're different purposes. You know, if you had taken that $1,000 and put it in your 401k, it'd be really hard to take out to pay for that thing. So before people think about retirement, I say, let's make sure we have some emergency savings. Let's make sure we pay off any super high interest debt. If you have a credit card loan or credit card balance at, you know, 20%,
Get rid of that first. Okay. So wipe out the credit cards, get back to zero.
Well, you know, there are things like mortgages and student loans that can have reasonable percentages or APRs that I would say it's not necessary to pay them off. Mm-hmm. You know, you might have bought a car where the, you know, incentive was 0% APR for 6 years. You know, I wouldn't say you got to go pay that car off.
Right.
But if you got credit cards at 25%, you know, we've definitely seen scenarios where people didn't realize that paying off those credit cards was worth doing.
Right.
And these are people with real money, like real amounts of savings that were like, well, I don't want to dip into my savings to pay off my credit card. And the framework we shared was, well, your credit card is costing you 20% and your savings isn't earning you 20%.
Right.
The only way that I know of to earn 20% comes within a lot of risk.
Bitcoin.
So man, let's not go there. Yeah. So, you know, paying off high interest debt is number one to make sure that if something happens, you don't have to borrow to fix it.
That's fair.
Step two is more short-term focused. Can you afford the things you need next year than the year after? If you have a child and you need to cover the cost of delivery, if you have someone going to preschool, let's figure that out.
Okay.
Then it's, what do you need for the future? The easy rule, which a group of professors, I think at Trinity University, did a study, and the outcome of that was that the safe withdrawal rate from a retirement account was 4%. And what that means is, if you have an amount saved, you can safely take 4% out for the rest of your life and you'll be okay. So if you say, I have $1 million saved for retirement, I can take 4% out every year and not have to worry, which would be $40,000, which for lots of people is enough to live on.
How does that adjust for inflation though?
Yeah, so that's a net of inflation number. So obviously your money grows. You know, I think a common assumption is that your money will grow if invested in a long-term portfolio at something around 7%, and then inflation will be around 3%, meaning that your amount of growth each year that isn't going towards inflation is about 4%.
Right.
And that's kind of where it came to.
Gotcha.
And they did this study over many, many years. If you look over the last 100 years, and
so you
look
just have to back into, okay, my wife and I spend $75,000 a year. So this is the number that I need to actually have before I can. And obviously there's like gravy on top of that. If you go off and start a little side business or
something. Yeah. If you
like
have
that.
A side business, if you inherit money, if you have any Social Security income, you know, if you aren't doing as much, you know, most people, as they're closer and closer to retirement, they might travel a lot early on, but you know, my grandmother's not traveling much. So her travel budget's gone down quite a bit. So now her health costs might have gone up. So, you know, you kind of look at what you need to spend in retirement to live and multiply that by 25. And that's the amount you'll need to be able to comfortably do that for the rest of your life.
How do you think about a portfolio changing over time to eventually get to this point of, you know, that kind of 4% retirement mode? Like, do you see, okay, if you're in your 20s, I want to get really aggressive, I'm going to do a bigger basket of tech stocks, blah, blah, blah. And then as I get older, I'm going to get a lot more conservative, like a little bit more fully diversified. Like, do you think like that? Or do you just set up one plan and kind of like set it and forget it?
Yeah. So traditionally, the easiest way to think about this is if you look at your 401k, you know, there are typically options that are like target date fund, you know, 2040 retirement fund. It's like, if you want to retire at 2040, this portfolio will match the amount of risk you should be taking and slowly decrease the risk as you need access to that money. And you're not going to get rid of all of it because, you know, the average person, you know, if you're 35 and you want to retire at 65 and you want to live till 95, over the next 30 years, you need to save enough money to live for 30 more years.
Right.
Which means that at the date you retire, some of that money still has a 29-year horizon.
Right.
So, you know, you never want it wouldn't go to risk zero and just all cash at the retirement date, but it'll adjust over time for someone of that typical age.
What do you know, there's a lot of tools out there, you know, and different companies that have put together, like you said, these target funds. So like, you know, you can go to Vanguard and they have a whole slew of different funds. They'll have dates on them. Say, if you plan on retiring in this particular date, this is the fund you probably want to invest your money in. You know, then there's the whole brand new set of different types of companies like Wealthfront, which I'm an investor in, full disclosure, and a whole slew of other ones, whether there's Personal Capital does Betterment. What do you think about that more kind of like brokerless robo investing, like say like a Wealthfront and or saying something that's a little bit more traditional, like a Vanguard type approach?
Sure. So the Wealthfront approach is really very similar to a target date fund. You know, a target date fund would just hold a bunch of other funds within it. if you did it at Vanguard, they'd be a bunch of low-cost ETFs. And what Wealthfront is doing is they're buying a bunch of Vanguard often, but other kinds of ETFs, and building together a portfolio. They've built a little bit more technology around it to try to make sure that maybe they can rebalance more frequently.
Does that stuff work? Like they call it like the harvesting, the tax loss harvesting. Yeah.
You know, I think the way the current tax, you know, and I'm not an accountant, this is not tax advice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you are in a circumstance where you have losses, you know, you can sell something and buy something else that's similar, but not exactly the same.
Right.
And, you know, keep those losses to offset gains one day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the tricky thing is most people in a retirement account or a long-term investment account, all of those things will end up going up. So there aren't going to be a lot of long-term losses. There could be some day-to-day losses, some early losses, but long-term, they tend to go away. And ultimately, if you sell something when it's lower and buy something else, you're buying that other similar thing at a lower cost basis.
Mm-hmm.
So there's going to be more liability. So it's particularly valuable for people who have other capital gains that they can use those losses against, because most long-term investment portfolios are going to have long-term capital gains treatment.
Right.
So there's definitely value to doing it. The value differs on a case-by-case basis. I wouldn't argue not doing it if it's a possibility, but I think that depending on your circumstance, the value might not be as great as it would for someone else.
Gotcha. Do you have a budget?
In 2013 was the first year that I thought, I'm going to make a budget. And it was actually less a budget than a spending kind of summary. So in anticipation of this, I asked my wife, which she begrudgingly agreed to categorize every transaction.
Oh my God.
We made for the
surprise,
entire,
you're still married, dude.
The entirety of 2013. And so at the end of the year, we were able to say how much money did we spend on travel, on food, on dining, on restaurants, on everything. And we get to a very precise number. I think it was $56,000 was what in 2013 we were spending.
That is amazing.
And
you're gonna keep it that low.
After that point, you know, I was like, okay, so what do I want to do going forward?
Wait, what were you using, by the way? Were you using Mint or?
So for that, we both used Mint.
Do you like QuickBooks or any of those others? Personal Capital is my favorite.
So Personal Capital has a tool that's very similar to Mint's tool with a bit more detail on the investment side.
Mint has too many ads, dude. It's like a freaking ad fest in there. Do you use an ad blocker?
I don't use an ad blocker, but when I use Mint, to be clear, I used Mint to categorize and aggregate all my transactions, and then I exported them all to a, you know, Excel
or
Google spreadsheets and went through it there.
Yeah.
I would say the difference between a Mint or a Personal Capital, which is much more reactive, right? It's let's categorize what we spent money on and see how we're doing. There's a piece of software that has a massive like diehard fan base called YNAB, which is You Need a Budget. It is a very popular piece of budgeting.
Does it
software.
Tie into all of your accounts?
It syncs with your accounts.
Is it for Mac? Can I?
I believe it's web, Mac, PC.
YNAB.
YNAB. I know.
Heard
it's
of this
crazy thing that when you search for it, you'll realize that so many people are using it. But the difference is it's like a proactive budget. There's intention behind it because you say, I want to spend this, and you see what goes into it. Versus Mint and Personal Capital, you see, this is how much I spent on.
Right.
And so for people who are really trying to rein in spending or come up with a plan that fits in with their goals, you know, something where you're putting a little bit more intention behind your budgeting makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. You know, QuickBooks for me is horrible on the Mac. It is horrific. Not QuickBooks, sorry, Quicken. QuickBooks actually is shocking that they're from the same company because it's a lot better than Quicken.
And Mint.
Same company. Yeah, it's a nightmare. Well, I want to wrap things up because we've gone all over the place, but I wanted to ask you, just because you're so good at this stuff with all the points and the different hacks, is there anything that we haven't covered in terms of like, you know, employee benefits that people might want to take advantage of, or like other little things that you're incorporating in your life that you consider to be kind of novel and that things that folks could learn from and make use of?
Yeah, I'll try to fly through this, but I think there are a few specific things that people probably spend too much money on, or if optimized, could be saving a lot.
Okay.
We talked about one, which is travel. So, you know, if you spend a lot of money on travel and you aren't doing it with miles or points, there is a massive opportunity there. Rewind about 20 or 30 minutes. And
any websites they should be using to learn more about this stuff?
Yeah. So there's so many blogs. There's the Points Guy, which is one of the most well-known ones, where you can really like dig into it deep. The challenge is, you know, I would go to those blogs and I would look at the high level, you know, overview, but don't feel the need to get into like, what's the best credit card today? What's the best credit card tomorrow? There are a lot of people that do something called churning, which is signing up for credit cards to get the really high signup bonuses. And
you then do that.
Waiting till the end of the year and canceling.
Do you churn?
You
churn a little bit.
I definitely get excited when a credit card has high signup bonuses. That's for sure. The question is, is it better at the end of the year to keep it? Is it better at the end of the year to put it into a no annual fee card? And how often? There are people that will sign up for 3 or 4 credit cards every quarter. You know, I am not in that camp.
Wow.
So I would say the people that are really into churning are signing up for maybe 15, 20 credit cards a year.
Oh my God.
And it's a lot to manage. It's a lot. It's crazy. They have to come up with ways to spend money to get the bonuses. So there was a year where almost everyone that was trying to do this was buying dollar coins from the US Mint. And then they would buy them by the like crate fulls so that they could spend money on their credit card, because the government needed to get the coins into circulation. And so they were willing to eat the credit card fees. So you could go online, you could buy $5,000 of dollar coins, they'd mail them to your house, and then people would put them in their car, drive them straight to the bank and deposit in their account and pay off their credit card. There's a great post someone had from a long time ago where he bought pudding. And so there was a deal with like, if you use the purchase proof of purchase on pudding cups, you could earn miles, and he found that it was cheaper. So he bought like thousands of pudding cups and then he eventually donated all the pudding to charity and had millions of miles.
Wow, that's amazing.
So travel would be one. Cars, people spend a lot of money on cars. They depreciate. They're, you know, always
bad
worth
for the
less down the road. They're bad for the environment. I would say get a bicycle, walk, move closer to work. You know, commuting is something that is not traditionally associated with happiness in life. Food, buy groceries. Usually you can eat healthier if you eat at home, better for your life.
100% agree.
House, you know, one of the things that's funny is people buy or rent a house that is bigger to move into their needs later. Don't get a 3-bedroom house because you want to have 2 kids in 5 years. Wait till you have the kids to, you know, or you're about to have the kids to get a house to hold it, because otherwise you're paying for space you don't need for a few years. And housing is really expensive, especially here. And then one of the last few is related to kind of government or employer incentives. FSAs and HSAs, you know, for example, my wife had mentioned that she wanted to do LASIK. She's eligible for LASIK. And so we're both going to max out our FSA for next year.
Explain to people what an FSA is.
Yeah. So an FSA is a flexible spending account.
And everyone has access to this?
Every employer has the ability to offer them. You know, not every person might work for a company that has them.
Okay.
If they do, and I'd say it's pretty common, there are some for different use cases, dependent care, for childcare. But the most common one is for healthcare expenses. And if you have an FSA, you can put money into it pre-tax, and you use that money over the next year on expenses. So when I did my Invisalign, I put money into an FSA so that I could use that to get pre-tax Invisalign. My wife wants to do LASIK next year. We're both going to max out our FSA.
How much can you put in per year?
I think last year, and I don't know if it changed, was $2,600.
And this can be for any health-related thing?
For most health-related things. I know it doesn't work with like cosmetic surgery, but it works for your copays, for your doctor's office. It works for prescriptions.
Wow.
It works for Advil.
How do you, let's just say you put in, you know, everyone's got their own medical expenses per year. Let's say you put in $1,000 a year. How do you get that out then to pay for those expenses?
Yeah. So most of the companies will send you a debit card that you can use to pay for everything. If for some reason that's not possible, you can send them a receipt and they'll send you a check.
And you don't pay any federal or state tax on that money then?
It's pre-tax money you can put in there.
That's awesome.
Yeah. HSAs are the same. They're even better.
What is an HSA?
So an HSA is a health savings account.
Okay.
Functionally very similar, except you have to use your FSA every year. I think you can only roll over $500 to the next year, and an HSA lasts with you forever. So HSA, you can put pre-tax money in. You can invest that money. They all have investment options. That money can grow over your entire life. And then you can spend that money on healthcare expenses later in life when, you know, it might be even more expensive.
Wow.
So I think those are like the top things. One of the biggest things is just getting in the mindset of focusing on, you know, things that will enrich your life and make you happier instead of things that, you know, a nice fancy car, a nice bag, a nice pair of shoes. Like,
right.
Does that really drive happiness? I've got a good hack that is quite timely. just leaving less free time. You know, people spend money when there's lots of free time. So my co-founder said, people should just, you know, just work a little harder and then you have less time to spend money. Another office idea this week was meditate.
Yes.
If you have some free time, I used Oak this morning.
Oh, sweet. Thank you.
Yeah. It's a great way to spend time. It doesn't cost anything. That's one. There's some crazy stuff. We were talking about Peloton.
Yeah.
Instead of buying a Peloton, I bought a spin bike and I used the Peloton app to save a little bit.
I think that's ridiculous, by the way. So here's, for people that don't know what a Peloton is, it's this like connected bike where you can race against your friends. And granted, they are expensive. They're a couple thousand dollars. I freaking love mine. I use it at least 4 or 5 times a week. It's how I primarily stay in shape. And I'm telling Chris about this and I was like, that's awesome, blah, blah. And of course, being the optimizer that he is, he didn't want to go out and spend $2,000 on a bike. So you bought what, a stationary bike off of Amazon?
Yeah, good one. It's very high quality.
Actually, I was pretty impressed when I came over to see it. And then he hooks up a little, little iPad, or what are you using on?
Yeah, so I use Wahoo Fitness. They have a cadence sensor and a speed sensor that lets you get all the same metrics you get.
How much did you save?
I'd say the whole thing all in was at or slightly under $400.
Okay. Wow. That's amazing. You know what we'll do in the show notes? I'll link up all that stuff. And by the way, for everyone, I know I mentioned this at the beginning of the show, or I will when I record the intro, is that we are not affiliated with any of this stuff that we've mentioned. So any credit cards that I link up in the show notes will not have affiliate codes or anything crazy like that. We are going to, this is obviously just for information purposes. Yep. If there is Amazon stuff, I'll link up my affiliate code for that. So if you buy a Peloton, a fake Peloton, I'll get a few bucks. But yeah, so, well, I want to wrap things up. This has been awesome, Chris. Thank you for being on the show. I wanted to also plug your company because I think that you guys are doing great things in that you're helping people figure this stuff out and put together financial plans and really get their lives straightened out. So if people want to sign up for or check out the service that the startup that you have, where can they do that?
So if people want to check it out, you can go to usegrove.com/Kevin. And right now we're still in kind of beta or alpha mode, but if you go to that URL, I'll make sure you jump the line.
Oh, sweet. Yeah. Cause I know you have a queue of it's long.
We have a wait list right now, but we are working to get through it quickly. We're working to grow so that we can make it faster, but come through that URL and we'll jump the line.
Awesome.
And yeah, we'll get you, you know, the way the product would work today is you sign up. We'll make sure you do a quick call with one of our financial planners to make sure that what we're doing is a good fit. And then we'll work together with our financial planners and you to figure out what the right plan is for your money.
Yeah. And you guys are, what do you call, you're a certified?
We are a registered investment advisor, which holds us to a fiduciary responsibility, which means that we are legally required to act in your best interest. To most people, that seems like, of course, isn't every financial advisor that? But as I think we talked about before, 90% of financial advisors in the United States are not held to a standard to act in your best interest.
That's crazy to me.
So it was really important to us when we started the company that we would always act in our clients' best interests. So you can hold us to that. The advice we give will always be what's best for you. We're rolling out a lot of new stuff over the next, 6 to 12 months. But even today, you can get started, work with a financial planner, build a plan, and we'll leave you with very actionable recommendations on how you can get on track.
Awesome. Well, Chris, thank you for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to that episode. If you want to check out any of the links that we talked about, and we talked about quite a few, head on over to kevinrose.com/podcast. And there will be the show notes there. You can click in there and click through to any of the different various services that we talked about. One last thing, if you can head on over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review to search for the Kevin Rose Show, that would really help in getting this podcast recommended to other people. The more people that rate it and review it, the higher it gets ranked inside of iTunes and the more people that will enjoy this content. So thank you so much for doing that. Be well.